We're talking with Ray Stanford, whose book, Socorro Saucer in a Pentagon Pantry, is now available. If you write to Ray, it's a nice looking book, too. He's selling these first editions, signed, personalized to you if you're interested. And we can give you information on how to contact Ray through the program. When we come back, a little bit about Lonnie Zamora, whether he was trustworthy or not, and then continue our conversation about attempts to discredit this case by the Air Force and by others. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Ray Stanford, I wanted to mention something before we get too far off the subject matter. A guy named Kevin Randall, Captain Kevin Randall, who's a really pretty good and meticulous researcher, had written a blog, an article, sort of a column about the hoax story. It was amazing to me how far and how quickly that hoax explanation spread and how it stuck. I think people just read the headline, oh yeah, that's a hoax, and that kind of stuck in their head and didn't bother to read any of the specifics. But Kevin Randall had made the point that, look, if this was a hoax and university officials knew about it being a hoax, wouldn't they have just kind of let the Air Force know instead of having the Air Force spin its wheels and waste a bunch of time down there all the time that it spent investigating the case? Wouldn't somebody have told them? What do you think about that?
Well, it's a good point. And another point, which I think maybe it was Kevin that made that in the same thing to which you refer. Normally when, let's use vernacular, smart-ass hoaxers, kids, decide to, oh boy, we fooled somebody, we fooled a cop or something like this, they love to brag about it. They don't do it just to fool the guy. They love to show off their smarts. If this had been a student hoax, and it couldn't have been because it doesn't match the facts, but had it been, they would have been bragging about it very shortly, and there was nothing of that because it didn't happen. I'd like to go back, if I might. I mentioned there were two good intelligence reasons for obfuscating the red insignia. One that Captain Holder, proper to Zamora, was that then if we get copycat hoaxes, we will know it because they will put the wrong symbol. And to make that even more effective and assured, they not only changed the symbol from the inverted V with three lines to the arc with the arrow vertical under it and a line under that, which is the fake symbol, they also changed the size. The more had seen it as maybe two to three feet across. They changed it and saying it was from 12 to 18 inches across. They reduced the size by 50%. So a person said, well, I saw a red symbol. Don't know exactly what it was, but it looked like about a foot across. Even that would tend to suggest that that there may be a hoax. Now, let me go to the second important one, in my opinion, the Air Force's view of the Division of Foreign Technology. They had the meeting down at Holloman to try to see if this was a black project craft with no results. But let's think about it this way. Suppose it had been a black project craft. If there were an insignia on it, and by the way, laws carefully control what kind of things are written on craft that fly in the United States, but had there been an insignia on it, and the real insignia got out, then if it were a truly important black project craft that needed to be hidden, someone could trace it back to its source by the insignia. Therefore, it would be important to obfuscate it while knowing the real insignia, having people think it was something else. So both of these are legitimate intelligence concerns or applications to obfuscation or hiding of the real symbol. I simply wanted to point that out and say that I believe that one of several reasons Zamora never wanted to talk to his kids or his wife about this, he didn't want to lie about it, and he was the kind of man that once he promised something, he was a man of his word. That was one thing about Zamora. I have interviewed hundreds of people making sometimes claims a lot wilder than this, some of them quite straightforward and honest claims, but I've never met anyone that I felt was more cautious in saying the right thing and not distorting or not letting anyone's comments distort what he felt he saw and described. And I classify Zamora as absolutely 100% on the scale of integrity in that respect.
You mentioned in the book that in addition to this, I mean, you know, we've talked about this latest story explaining it away as a hoax, but there were earlier attempts by the master skeptic debunker of all time, Phil Klass, who wrote about this case and tried all kinds of things to dismiss it, describing it as a hoax, one in which Lonnie Zamora played an active role, that he and the mayor conspired to do this so they could draw some tourists to the area. What do you say to that one?
I laugh. In the first place, the first thing he claimed was that this was a big ball of plasma that had escaped from nearby electric lines and had fooled Dickens out of this policeman, landed on four landing gear and took off and had a red insignia on his side, but he claimed it was a ball of plasma. Well, it happens that the late Dr. James McDonald was a senior atmospheric physicist of the University of Arizona, Tucson. I had visited with him at LINC down there. Wonderful man. And he immediately shot class down and embarrassed the heck out of him. Here's an atmospheric physicist that it's impossible. For one thing, atmospheric conditions were wrong. It flew off completely against the wind. And furthermore, of course, they don't have red insignias on their side or landing gear. But so
Heine, little beings back, inside either.
In other words, he back Phil Class backed down on this immediately. Then came up with his second escalation or de-escalation, I should say, of a hypothesis, in claiming that that it might be a hoax to get tourists to Socorro on land owned by the mayor. Well, I've never ascertained that the land was owned by the mayor, but the point is, to this day, there has never been a sign up saying, here's where, go see what Socorro landed, or they haven't been any vending or anything else to sell souvenirs, nothing whatsoever to promote it as a tourist attraction, which completely shoots down that. But furthermore, even if you claim it were such a thing, you'd have to explain the details, and they cannot be. There were, I should say, additional witnesses, as you know. In the first place, most people don't know this, but Sam Chavez told fellow police officers that as he was approaching the site, he saw a little round object, right where Zamora said it should be, way up in the sky above the general direction of the Perlite Mill, disappearing with distance very quickly. But he did see it lead. Then there are the two witnesses that I showed the photographs of in my book, Kaizen Kratzer, that reported seeing it from over on Highway 60. Someone came along and said, oh, that's got to be a hoax, because they said they saw smoke coming up in that direction, and they... Zamora never described any smoke. Indeed, he didn't describe any smoke, but what he did describe, while Kaizen Kratzer, if you take the timing of their event and their location on Highway 60, just west of the site, they're looking over there. Zamora is climbing the hill. He doesn't get up until the third try. In the first two, he's spinning his wheels and knocking up, and he said, knocking up a lot of dust. What they saw, I'm confident, was the dust being knocked up by Zamora, spinning his wheels, going up the sandy, gravelly, dusty slope there on the east of the landing site. And there doesn't take any magic to explain that as the smoke they thought they saw. So there also were the two women that Radio KSRC Walter Schrode, owner, and I talked to in the restaurant that night, who had heard the roar. They heard a terrible roar, but they didn't go out. They thought, well, gosh, this is something we've never heard from White Sands before. We've heard a few sounds, but nothing this loud. But they didn't go out. I mean, after all, nobody said Zamora was out there watching an object. And then they stayed in their homes, and they heard it take off again, both of them. There also was, according to Lonnie Zamora, there was a woman who actually saw the takeoff and, I believe, the landing. She never went public. But... Now, there are people who claim they saw it that didn't. I've talked to one, but there are people that always try to get in on the act. But anyway, it was a rather well-witnessed case, but even if the witnesses did not exist, the additional ones, for the Air Force, from Hector Quintanilla, who was head of the Blue Book part of it, for him to say that this one got him and complain about it for the rest of his life, and to tell afterward the CIA that they could never explain it, that carries a lot of weight when you've convinced a guy like Hector Quintanilla, along with Dr. Hynek.
You had mentioned some of the physical evidence that you found to be significant was the radiation levels. There's radiation, a lot of radiation, I would imagine, in New Mexico from a variety of programs. Right. But is there what was the level? Is there a way to compare it to background radiation that makes it exceptional?
Here's all we can say about the evidence, the radiation. It was it affected Ted Jordan's films at certain of his pictures, apparently the ones right at the site, which they took out to the site on that Sunday with the radiation counter. Apparently, they said the document says specific slides. Well, he's the only one that took slides, and specific slides because there were only certain ones that showed this effect. And by the way, let me mention in this context that I was the only person who ever discovered this fact. And there have been lies written about it in another book claiming that that they had discovered. They did not. I can prove it. I have the affidavit from Ted B. Jordan, the state policeman, whose film was taken and never returned to him, telling about how it would not be returned to him because it was damaged by radiation. But in that, in fact, he mentions that he did not know it until I told him. How did I know it? Because I went to Socorro on the 26th of August, 1964. Hynek had been there on the 15th. And Ted Jordan had been pushing Zamora, if you ever see this guy Hynek again, ask him why I didn't get my film back, that I'm a little upset. And so Zamora asked him. And he said, well, they couldn't return it because it had effects of radiation and it might lead to the interpretation and the understanding of some advanced technology, and they couldn't do that. Well, he told Zamora that. And when I got into town, Zamora told me, and my friend Bob McGarry, he told us this. And the funny thing is, he never went over and told Ted Jordan about it. He just didn't like to talk about this. Ted didn't learn about it until I told him. And he got the facts then, verified it, and signed an affidavit. But I got better proof than that. It's not hearsay. I have a video. There was a commercial TV station that was there to cover my UFO tracking project in Austin. And afterward, I said, hey, would you do me a favor and just do a tape for me? Dr. Hynek is here. And we sat down out in front of the office building, and they taped us. And Hynek confesses, under my questioning, that, in fact, there was the film, and it showed the effects of radiation, and the Air Force could not release it because it looked as though it might give evidence of an advanced technology. And I want to mention that there's a serious possibility. James Fox, the producer of the movie that they're working on, has said that he would very much like to have this in the movie. And, of course, I like James a lot and would love for them to do it. If they go forward with the movie and decide to use this, it'll be in there so people can see Hynek verifies something. He was the head of MEGIN, the Air Force Scientific Consultancy, on this, and he confesses that the Air Force could not release this because of the radiation. But the next day, pictures were taken by Sam Chavez with a Polaroid camera, which is a different medium, but they did not show the effects of radiation. This suggests, to use radiation terms, a short half-life isotope. In other words, whatever was in that landing exhaust that penetrated the ground and didn't bounce off. It didn't bounce off like a rocket engine, Zamora said. He'd seen him tested at White Sands. It did not react with the ground the way a plasma jet would have. But it appears to have been subatomic particles, perhaps accelerated near the speed of light, where they have mass and thus produce thrust. And in doing so, the particles get absorbed by materials in the ground, but they are thrown off, re-radiated over a short period of time as short half-life isotopes. The state MUFON, the head of MUFON for the state in New Mexico, Dr. Don Burleson, has in fact presented several presentations about this case that I had pointed out to him and talked about how short half-life radiation would do this. And that's exactly the kind of thing you'd get if the propulsion was the type that I just described and that I also went into a little detail on in my book. So this is a very important thing, this radiation. And it was totally, there is no mention of it whatsoever in the Air Force files except the slip that they took certain slides there with the radiation detection equipment because they had to go to the spots where the radiation was coming from.
Did you say in the beginning of the program that at the news conference there that was held that Hynek misled reporters? He left out, did he omit or lie about the beings that were seen there?
I encourage people to read the exact text of it in the book. Well, let me put it this way. I described it in the book as pussyfooting, if people know the old term. But and Hynek told me, he said, I let him read the manuscript before it was published, and he eventually wrote me a nice letter commending it intended for use in his promotion. And he said, Ray, I don't like what you said, but you gave me what I had coming to me for that media conference. He was real honest and real straightforward about it. Here's what happened. 20 minutes before, we'd been standing in the ravine, Chavez, Zamora, and me. And Zamora, as I said, puts his hand right at this place in the bush. He said the head of this person that looked like a 10-year-old kid was standing. It was right here. It didn't come above this place. And I said, so how would you classify it? And he said, well, yeah, like, you know, again, just a little 10-year-old kid maybe. And so he said this. We went to a media conference, and they asked him, has Zamora described to you any small occupants out the side of the table? He didn't say anything about any occupants. He said something about some white coveralls that he saw outside of it. And of course, that's almost laughable. But you can read the exact text of it in the book. But what Hynek was doing, he was towing the line that the FBI agent asked him to do, that no little people were seen outside of it. Whereas, ironically, 20 minutes before, so one can call it a whitewash pussyfooting or a kind of a devious lie, all the same, Hynek definitely tried to hide that these minutes documents were seen. And there's no question, there's no mistake that they were small, because Zamora showed us where the heads came relative to the bush, and we were standing right there and saw how small they were relative to us.
You know, the book has a lot of really great photos and some artwork, a recreation of the scene, what happened there. One of the photos that grabbed my attention was of this rock, and you have an affidavit under it, handwritten by Lonnie Zamora, indicating that who was present at the time that he was making the statement was Alan Hynek and Chavez, and then you. And he said that this rock had been chipped by whatever it was, that the foot of this craft that sat down there.
Yes. Yes, apparently there was a weak place in the rock that had a little bit of calcite in the lesion. We call it a mineralization lesion. And when the landing gear had crushed down on top of it, it knocked a little chip off, which I didn't find. Somebody probably already carried it off. They took every souvenir they could find. But here's this rock still buried with, when I pulled out and saw it, had the little bits of metal on it. The irony of this is, here I am, I'm 25 years and 10 months old, green, but experienced with UFO investigation itself. And we're standing there. Zamora points this out to us. And I said not a word deliberately, because immediately I said, uh-oh, there's going to be metal scraped on that probably, or whatever material is on that landing gear might be scraped onto it. Hynek said, yes, I think a heavy object might do that. That's exactly what he said. But he didn't put two and two together and come up with four, that this rock might have traces left on it. So I was holding my breath and hoping, and sure enough, he went on up to the car, and Chavez drove him over to the El Rio Motel, and I followed and came there for the media conference. And he never thought or said another word about it until he saw until he heard what happened with the metal.
You know, there was, in addition to the other witnesses who saw something out there, there were other incidents in that same time period, a lot of them.
There were a lot of sightings. There was one where it was claimed a little girl was burned by a UFO. That was a hoax. Also, I don't give any credence to the La Madera case of a fellow named Gallegos. I won't go into details, but it was a one witness case, but it, in my opinion, is not credible. When the Air Force officer went there to interview him around 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the afternoon, he was so he smelled so much of alcohol, the officer could not stand to stay in the car with him, hardly. When he let him off where he picked him up, they'd gone out to the site. At around or a little after 6 o'clock, he said the smell of alcohol was still that strong. And whether the guy had a real sighting, they're just details about it. Everything was wrong. It did not replicate at all the Zamora case, contrary to the reports. And it's just not credible. But there were a lot of, in my opinion, credible cases that we didn't go into detail, neither the Air Force nor I, because simply they were reports, but they didn't have the kind of physical evidence we were dealing with and the credibility we were dealing with in Zamora.
Okay. You know, there have been a lot of attacks on you personally over the years. I mean, some of it really nasty. And preparing for this program, I looked up some things online, and wow, you've really brought out the people carrying daggers over the years. I guess it comes with the territory, huh?
Yes. If you'd like to address any of the accusations, I'll be happy to address them.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to go to a break here in a second, so maybe we'll do that on the other side. And then I'd like to have you summarize the Socorro case, and then maybe we'll talk a little bit about some of your dinosaur hunting. I think people would be interested in hearing about that, because some of the findings you've made, I mean, it's world-class kind of discoveries, and you basically have found this stuff in your own backyard. And I think folks would like to hear it. So stick around, everyone. We have an additional segment with my guest, Ray Stanford, talking about the Socorro saucer case. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We have one segment remaining with Ray Stanford talking about his book, Socorro Saucer in a Pentagon Pantry, and we'll expand the conversation to include some dinosaur tracking as well right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Ray, anything else to say about the Socorro case? You want to sum it up about how important you think it is in the pantheon of UFO cases?
There's a lot more that I haven't shared that I could talk about. There's some evidence, in fact, that if it pans out the way it looks early on, maybe the most important physical evidence shining light on advanced propulsive technology that has ever been presented in any UFO case.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay, here's the thing. When I was at the site with Alan Hynek, we looked mainly for paper, burned paper, and we found some paper with kind of interesting burns. I'm not saying they prove anything, but what I found right in the area where the bush was sliced in half, and where the landing exhaust and takeoff engine had played into the ground, apparently, as the more described, knifing into the ground, I found a small rock there that had been overlooked by the earlier investigators, probably because right near it, to one side of it, there had been a large volcanic-type rock that appeared to, well, the police described it as looking as if it had been burned and kind of melted, bubbly from melting. This had been taken, and apparently, according to the Air Force records, it must have been, at Holder's suggestion, taken over to White Sands. I don't know what the Army did with it, but this was probably important evidence that's not at all mentioned in the Blue Book files. But I picked up a little rock there of a different type that wouldn't have been noticed as having been altered. The typical rock that they found was bubbly, so-called, was a type that was is around there in great numbers. It's an old volcanic type of rock that's pushed up by ancient volcanism from down underneath the earth. This piece was different. It's a small piece, about 2 inches across, and the remarkable thing about it is that it appears to have, it has crystals in it that grew in, of course, in the matrix when it was cooling from a magma. But the crystals, many of the crystals in it, including the tiny groups of crystals called agate or chalcedony, appear to be melted. I want to have some final tests before I say for sure. But if the crystals are as they appear under the microscope, to be melted, and it's easy to tell. We'll be able to do this very soon. It's easy to tell if they are in fact crystal because a crystal will refract light in a certain way. Usually, it's called birefringence in two directions. But if it's a melt, it won't do that. It's just a glass, and we can easily determine that. If it is a glass, it is incredibly important because there are only well, it's very difficult to produce to turn crystals into a glass in a piece of rock without turning the whole rock into a melt. There are only two ways, theoretically, that I know of that could be done. One happens on Mars when an asteroid hits the surface of Mars and knocks up, let's say, a volcanic rock, a magmatic cumulate, knocks it into space, and eventually falls to Earth as a so-called Martian meteorite. It changes a mineral that's in the rock that is called plagioclase. At that moment and instantaneously that it's hit, it changes that mineral into a glass, called a diplectic glass or mescalinite. And we can date how long ago it was turned into that glass when we get to Earth and get it into the laboratory. So there is an incredible high-energy event that does it without melting the whole rock, but just melts certain crystals. We wouldn't expect this in this rock here. It's not a meteorite. But the other way of doing that would be to have a magnetic resonance play on it in such a way that certain crystals of the right size or resonance effect begin to vibrate until they generate enough heat to melt without melting the matrix of the rock. That is what it appears. And underline appears because we don't know for sure yet. We need to test it. But if, in fact, this is melt and the rock itself is not melted, the implications are immense because it strongly suggests a high-energy magnetic resonance of some type, which is exactly what we would expect in the propulsive system that would leave short half-life radiation that I mentioned before at the site. So that is very, very exciting. Now, there's some other things that I should tell you about, and I'm going to lay a real surprise on you, George. In my book, you'll remember there's a photograph there that shows Alan Hynek taking a Polaroid shot in the direction of approach of the object.
Yes.
And I took a picture, of course, that's my picture showing Alan doing it, but Alan took a picture too. And years later, in fact, just in the last couple of years, 3 years or so, did I discover what I'm about to describe to you. I got in my book, you won't be able to see this clearly, it's low resolution, but you take the picture and enlarge it. out in the direction, well, Zamora had said that the object had approached in that direction because the tourist had seen it approach in that direction. He didn't see it pass across the highway. He didn't see it till he got over where it was coming down to land. But because they had said that, and he and Chavez accepted that, both of them pointed in the northeast and said that was the direction of approach. Well, by golly, I got to looking at the picture, and right there where the object would have been if we were back in time, there was an object there that I photographed. Well, it just happens that someone sent me a picture several generations down. I'd like to get back to the original, of the Polaroid of Hynek. But the same object is in Hynek's photograph. It's much lower resolution than mine, but we can know that the object is a real object because in my photograph, which is higher resolution, it's done with a Schneider lens on my Argus C3 camera. You will see that there are two things that are outstanding. There are multiple imaging trail behind it as if it shot in there at high speed, pulsing and stopped. But to the right of it, you will see what I call the ghost image. I have had a whole laboratory of instruments which we could talk about, but in daylight, numerous times, we have filmed these objects, and much to our shock, flying along beside them in some cases is a thing that is the ghost of the object, except it's a negative. What is dark in the target object is light and vice versa, and it goes right along the same path. This object also has that. There's no ordinary object that could produce this. Only UFOs that we have photographed, not all UFOs, but certain ones, show this. So we have that added thing. But anyway, Hynek's photograph, although very poor resolution, shows the object. And back in my photograph, up in the sky, there's a faint image of an elongated object that some might interpret as a mothership. I don't know, but it's there. It's also there in Hynek's picture. They were taken a few seconds apart. They're in ever so slightly different positions, but we have parallax because of our separation, Hynek and me, of about 8 feet and 8 or 9 feet. And so we have nice parallax that shows that the objects are, in fact, not near the camera, but they're off there about the distance. The object that would be in the position of the approach of the Zamora object is right there where it should have been. And it's quite amazing. And you can imagine my excitement when I found this. Now, when I went to the National Archive with James Fox, my major objective was to get Hynek's original Polaroid because it would show this much better from his picture. The picture that I had and that has they have at the archives even worse. It's about 3 to 5 generations at least down from the original. I'm going to try to find his original. But because here we have triangular photographs of an object almost as if, George, I mean, this is the crazy part. But sometimes these cases are crazier than we want them to be. The crazy part of it is it almost would sound like they were eavesdropping on us. They heard Hynek ask the question about the direction of approach, and as I said in a slide that I made up for this in PowerPoint, I said, and there they are using a figure of speech, only laughing their little green asses off, showing up right where the object was supposed to have approached. So here we have Hynek's picture and my photograph showing the same thing. They're not spectacularly detailed, but by golly, the same objects appear to be there in both photographs, and we have parallax, so I think that's important.
Wow, that is important. You know, the idea that they might be listening to us or paying attention or sort of zooming into our brains or something like that is might seem outlandish. It sort of goes along with what I was hearing, referring to before the break, that you've been attacked over the years. I think you did some psychic research earlier in your career, and some of the folks who don't want the saucer stuff to be true attack you for that. They use so-called research as you attempt to psychically communicate with ETs or something like that, and they're sort of poking fun at it. You've heard that before.
Let me mention that we never tried to communicate with ETs. That is a hoax that's been put out on the Internet, but absolutely that is false. Indeed, from 1960, early 1960 through 78 perhaps, I did work as a psychic. I put myself into an unconscious state. And we had some remarkable things. I think a lot of the stuff that comes through me or anybody else is pure BS. And I'll say that. And I don't believe that people should follow the lead of things that come through psychics. I think they should follow their own personal life guidance and internal feelings and intuition and grow better that way. And so I repudiate most of the things that we did in that time as that would that supposedly give various kinds of information inside as being questionable. On the other hand, I have to say, to be honest about it, that we had some very good evidence of psychism in those. For example, in 1972, there was a reading in which they suggested to my unconscious to try to reach information about the secret of Fatima. And it said that the major secret was that there would be an assassination or attempted assassination on a pope. And it told which pope after the time that the reading was taken in 72, which pope thereafter, the second or what, or third or whatever it was. It said that. Now, that's in the, you know, that's in the Library of Congress. It's in print. And it was in print before it happened. And the day that the pope was shot, I got calls from all over, people that had read that, saying, by gosh, Ray, do you realize that what was said in the readings had been confirmed? I'm not a pusher of readings. I don't even recommend people study this stuff. Some people claim they were helped by it, but I have I've moved beyond those days, and I got out of psychism because I found that too many people wanted to believe what had come to me as if it were gospel. They thumped my readings as you might the Bible, and I said, I will have none of that. It is ridiculous. And I would tell them stories. For example, there was a man who was very successful in commercial real estate in Austin, and he got a reading from me and asked a question related to his business. Certain information was given him. When the reading was over, I said, well, what was said by my conscience? And he told me, and I said, well, that's wrong. Let me tell you the truth. I said, if you want that guy to accept your proposal, you offer this amount, exactly this amount, 1 cent less, and he won't take it. Well, guess what? He went to the meeting the next day, and he offered that, and the guy said the exact words. He said, if you offered 1 cent less, I wouldn't have taken it. So, in other words, my conscious mind had worked better than my unconscious mind. And I'd say that should give us a word of caution about these things. And anybody who knows me in my personal life today knows that I'm not a psychic geek or kook, and that I am a good observer and a careful observer and a careful interpreter of what I see. That is proven in the absolutely world first that I've made in paleontology.
Let's talk about that, Ray. I have to think you sound pretty sane to me. You've done some amazing stuff as a dinosaur tracker, and you've done it right in your backyard, practically. Talk about it a little bit. We got about 5 minutes left.
Well, I got into this because my kids wanted to hunt for Indian artifacts in the streams. I had showed them some dinosaur tracks down in Texas, but it's a riverbed. And, you know, we read about dinosaurs. All, you know, if you have two boys and a girl, at least the boys are going to ask about dinosaurs. But we were in a bookstore one day, saw a secondhand book by Dr. Martin Lockley, University of Colorado, Tracking Dinosaurs. And, Daddy, let's get this book. Let's track some dinosaurs. Well, we're in the stream looking for Indian artifacts, and I looked down and I say, kids, what does this look like? Daddy, it's a dinosaur track. I said, but we just read in a book that no tracks had ever been found in this area. And so we dismissed it. But a few days later, I was in a stream nearby, and I found another one of the same type of dinosaur, which was an iguanodon. And I said, wait a minute. Maybe that wasn't just a fluke. Maybe we're discovering something here. So I went out the next weekend and found a track of one of these, you know, the long-necked plant eaters that sneezed on the little girl in Jurassic Park, sauropod, found a wonderful footprint of a sauropod dinosaur. And I said, Ray, you're going to have to get serious. Collect these, study them, and publish some scientific papers. And it ended, I published several scientific papers with Dr. Lockley himself, and ended up during one trekking trip, I found, right inside the D.C. Beltway, walking distance from my home, I found a new, not only species, but a whole new genus of dinosaur, an armored dinosaur. When they grow up, they're a big armored beast, and this one was the only hatchling of an armored dinosaur ever been found in the whole world, and the first hatchling of any kind of dinosaur found in the eastern United States, and it is now on nice display in the Smithsonian Institution American Museum of Natural History with a very nice picture of me beside it. So I brag and say I'm the only UFO researcher in the world that's got his picture up in the Smithsonian for finding dinosaurs.
Has anybody else, has this kicked off any kind of search by other dinosaur trackers on the East Coast hey, we haven't even been looking here?
Indeed, it has. One day I was, I had lunch. My wife at that time had not yet retired from, she was contracting officer technical representative over the whole supply side of the Hubble Space, the last three Hubble Space Telescope servicing missions. And I'd come over there to Goddard to have lunch with her. And I decided to drive around, and I saw sticking up out of the grass what looked like to me from a distance a dinosaur track went over. It was a big track of again, a notosaur, an adult notosaur. And so eventually I released this information to public affairs at Goddard, and to they, with their permission, the Washington Post, front page featured article, and they began to get really turned on. Twice I was able to drive into Goddard and see my own mug, as well as a picture of the track up on their big electronic signs as you drive in. When I was making various talks there, they asked me to give. It got to where people run at me, "Hey, you're the dinosaur man, stop." But a wonderful scientist there in the Earth Science Division took a real interest in it, and I've been training him, and he's becoming a good tracker, as well as one of the high-level accountants there who suddenly retired. But they've become very avid and excited trackers, and also others have followed up. You can no longer find anything of any importance, hardly, in the D.C. metro area because, frankly, I've collected it all. But we have branched off, and we're finding dinosaur tracks from other places. And I'm also presently under contract with the Goddard Space Flight Center, preparing the tracks that I found there for a display in the Earth Science building.
No kidding. It seems to me, Ray, you have a really nimble mind and a wide variety of interests, but your passion is always going to be Socorro. I think it's amazing to me that after all this time, you're still working on it. You're still tracking stuff down and doing research.
Well, that is correct, and I'll tell you what, I also have massive amount of daylight film and electronic evidences of actually better cases than Socorro that I hope sometimes we can get together on the show and talk about. And I promise you, I'll drop this little hint. If I can find a good agent for a new expanded version of the Socorro book, there will be released in the book a photograph in broad daylight of the Socorro object with its landing gear out.
You want to say any more about that? You got a photo, a daylight photo,
right,
of the Socorro object?
Well, not only that, there are two of them. There were two of them. One of them had its landing gear folded in. The other one had them out. And the photograph was taken in August of 1964. And I won't have time to go into the story here, but it is exciting. I have shared this with some major people. There's no question about the authenticity of the picture. None whatsoever. I can swear my life on it. It is genuine. And major people have seen this, including some aerospace scientists, Goddard Space Flight Center, and others, and everybody has accepted it as being absolutely real. It speaks for itself. The object with its landing gear out, according to the calculations, if it was the exact same size as the one as illustrated in my book, then it was almost exactly 1/2 mile from the camera, and it was the photograph was taken near the dynamite shack at the Socorro landing site. Looking to the west, maybe slightly northwest, and it was located approximately halfway between Highway 60 and the landing site. The one.
Well, I sure want to get a look at that sometime. We're going to have you come back, Ray, and maybe I'll see if I can rustle you up a publisher that wants to get into that. Thanks very much. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope people will check out your book, Socorro Saucer and a Pentagon Pantry. It's a classic. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, George.
And thank also to Dr. Jacques Vallée, my earlier guest, and my crew there. Welcome back. Gina Salvati is back with us on Coast to Coast. Our engineer tonight, Dan Galati, our webmaster, Lex Lonehood, and producer, Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Good night, everyone.